Your Excellency,
said Mariano,
I've got another team in Cyprus. I've already called them. They should be in Tel Aviv by nightfall. In the meantime, I'll try to contact our mole and see if I can pick up their trail.
You had better, Vigo, or I will have your head on a platter.
Chapter 39. Thursday, January 15th, 9:53 a.m. The road to Tiberias. Bennett glanced back in his rearview mirror. Natasha was staring out the window. Her eyes were red, and there were smudges of mascara on her cheeks. He looked at Aaron, who was poring over a map, no doubt planning a route to the Golan and several escape routes back. The three of them had been driving in near silence for almost 45 minutes. They would be in Tiberias any minute. Perhaps it was time to break the ice. You okay? He asked, again looking into the rearview mirror. Natasha wiped her eyes but did not look up.
I guess.
You want to talk about it?
Not particularly.
Aaron set her map down and turned to Natasha.
I would have liked to have gotten to know your grandfather more.
Natasha nodded.
You would have liked him. I already did.
They drove in silence another few minutes. Then, still gazing out the window at farmland covered with oil wells, Natasha said,
He was convinced he was going to live to see the temple rebuilt. For most of my life, I thought he was crazy. Even when I was studying to follow in his footsteps, I thought his obsession with the temple and the ark was all a little much.
It was quiet again for a few minutes. Then Natasha picked up the thought.
It's funny, she said softly. I thought of archaeology as the study of the past, but my grandfather always said it was about the future. What good is digging up relics today if it doesn't affect how we live tomorrow, he used to say. To him, finding the temple treasures wasn't simply about proving that the Jews controlled Jerusalem thousands of years ago. It was about setting into motion the building of the third temple and thus fulfilling the words of the Hebrew prophets.
But you didn't buy it? Asked Aaron.
He was the zealot in the family, not me. After my parents died, I decided there couldn't be a God so capricious that he would leave me and millions of other children around the world orphaned. But my grandfather never gave up on me. He wanted me to be a believer.
Again, they drove for a while in silence. Then John spoke up and said,
Forgive me, Natasha, but I'm curious. What exactly do Jewish people believe when it comes to rebuilding the temple?
In some ways, Natasha dreaded the question. It had been a mistake to say anything. She would have preferred to suffer in silence. But then again, her grandfather had taught her well, and perhaps the chance to pass along some of his knowledge would keep her mind off of how utterly alone she felt without him.
That's like asking Christians what they think about the Pope, she replied. Ask a Catholic, and you'll get one answer. Ask the Greek or Russian Orthodox, and you'll get quite another. Everything depends upon your point of view.
I've heard some people say that the building of the temple will precede the coming of the Messiah, Aaron said. Others say the Messiah will build it himself.
Well, you're right about that, Natasha replied. It's been an age-old debate. Even some of our wisest sages were confused. Read Maimonides. At various points he made the case for both sides, but the truth is, until the last few months, most Israelis, secular ones anyway, didn't believe the temple would ever be rebuilt, nor did they much care. With the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque there, it just seemed impossible.
Obviously, religious Jews, particularly the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox, believed it would happen, though most couldn't imagine how.
They said, Ever since we reunified Jerusalem and took control of the Temple Mount in 1967, the movement to rebuild has certainly been growing from just a handful of true believers into a very powerful force. They've been publishing books and holding conferences about it. They've been making implements for temple service and training priests in temple rituals. And then came October 13th, 2004.
What happened then? Asked Bennett.
They were now approaching the outskirts of the city, and Natasha could see the Sea of Galilee glistening in the morning sun.
That was the day the Sanhedrin was reconvened, right here in Tiberias, actually, for the first time in over 1,600 years.
The Sanhedrin?
Aaron asked, astonished.
The same one that condemned Jesus and sent him to Pilate, hoping the Romans would execute him?
Well, most Jews don't exactly think of that as the group's defining moment, but yes, that's the one, said Natasha.
The original Sanhedrin was the governing religious council of the temple, made up of the 71 most prominent rabbis in the country. They met in the temple. They oversaw its daily life and practice. After Jerusalem was sacked and the temple destroyed in the year 70, the Sanhedrin went underground. They were convinced the city and the sanctuary would be rebuilt. They were convinced the Messiah would come and make it all right, and they believed it would all happen soon. But years turned into decades, and decades into centuries. And around the year 425, those who were running the council finally gave up hope, and the Sanhedrin disbanded.
Until 2004, said Aaron.
That's right, said Natasha. That's when the Sanhedrin was reconvened, but that was only the beginning. On June 6, 2005, the Sanhedrin made news again. Big news, actually, at least in our house. I remember their statement verbatim because my grandfather drilled it into my head night and day. The Sanhedrin calls upon all groups who work in the area of temple and temple mount related research and activity to begin to prepare detailed architectural plans for the construction of the Holy Temple, towards the goal of its establishment in its proper place. The Sanhedrin will establish a forum of architects and engineers whose goal will be to implement this decision so that detailed working plans are effectively brought to an operational stage.
That's when I began to sit up and take notice of all this temple talk, Natasha confided, because it suddenly seemed like the train was really leaving the station. Now, remember, this was all long before the war of Gog and Magog. Few people in Israel realized what was coming or how the Muslim holy sites were going to be destroyed in a firestorm. But we still knew the rebirth of the Sanhedrin and the call to prepare detailed plans for the temple were dramatic developments, even me. And in my grandfather's eyes, they were prophetic ones. Why? Because it meant a significant shift had occurred in Jewish thinking. No longer did the majority of rabbis in Israel believe the Messiah would come and build the temple. Now they believed they were required to build the temple themselves in the last days, and then the Messiah would come. A few moments later, they found Ihad Ha'am Street, and Natasha tapped Bennett on the shoulder and pointed.
That one, she said. That's my cousin's house, the big one on the left.
Chapter 40. Thursday, January 15th, 10:10 a.m., Tiberias, Israel. They pulled into the driveway.
What did you say your cousin does? Aaron asked.
It was an enormous house with gardens surrounding it and a spacious two-car garage, all newly built on a cliff overlooking the Sea of Galilee.
She's the new VP of marketing for Medexco, said Natasha. Miriam Gozal. Do you know her?
Neither John nor Aaron did, but it reminded them both that they ought to give Dmitry Galishnikov a call when the coast was clear. They had just seen him at the wedding, and he would no doubt be mourning Mordecai's death. It doesn't look like anyone's here, said Bennett, after ringing the doorbell several times and peering in the vestibule window and seeing no one.
She might be in Europe, said Natasha. For the life of me, I don't know why she bought this place. She's never here.
They pulled the Mercedes into the garage, began poking around the enormous three-level home. It had seven bedrooms, four bathrooms, a gorgeous new Italian kitchen, and a huge office on the top floor, and no sign that anyone lived there but the cousin. Each floor had a wraparound balcony. On one of them, Natasha paused, staring out over the small but growing city of Tiberias below them, and the Golan Heights on the other side of the sea. Not wanting to leave her alone, the Bennets remained with her for a while, trying to enjoy the view despite all that had happened.
You look like you have another question, John, Natasha said softly.
I'm fine.
Really, it's okay. I'd rather answer your questions than wallow in my grief.
Well, it's just that I'm still curious about the temple treasures and the Ark.
What do you mean?
I mean, besides all those theories that you and your grandfather and these ex-CIA guys have about the Copper Scroll, does the Bible actually say they'll ever be found? Is that in any of the prophecies, or is this just...
Just what? Natasha asked. A fool's errand?
Bennett shrugged.
You mean, is this thing really worth risking your life for? Said Natasha.
Right.
Ever read Jeremiah chapter 27, verses 21 and 22?
She asked.
I don't remember, said Bennett.
I have a Bible,
Erin said. She pulled one out of her purse and looked up the passage.
Yes, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, concerning the vessels that are left in the house of the Lord, and in the house of the king of Judah, and in Jerusalem. They will be carried to Babylon, and they will be there until the day I visit them, declares the Lord. Then I will bring them back and restore them to this place.
See that? Said Natasha, looking out over the water. God promised to watch over the temple treasures and restore them to the Jewish people when the next temple was to be rebuilt. What's more, he kept that promise.
You're saying if God restored the treasures once, he'll do it again? Asked Aaron.
That's what most rabbis believe, said Natasha.
That's certainly what my grandfather believed. So did Uncle Eli.
And the Ark? Asked Bennett. Is that all Hollywood, or is there really a snowball's chance somebody's going to find it someday?
I think we're really going to find it, said Natasha. Is the Ark mentioned in the Copper Scroll?
Aaron wondered.
Actually, no, not once, said Natasha. Most scholars would tell you there's no connection. After all, you have to remember that the Ark was never in the Second Temple, so it seems unlikely that it would have been hidden away with the other temple treasures.
Then why are you so confident?
A few reasons, said Natasha. Remember the temple scroll we saw back at the museum, the really long one?
The Bennetts nodded.
It's actually the longest of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but more important, it lays out remarkably detailed plans for a third temple and describes the first and second temple vessels and furnishings all being present and accounted for, including the Ark.
Really? Asked Bennett. What does it say?
Natasha closed her eyes and drew up the words from deep within her soul.
And two cherubim you shall make at both ends of the cover, the one cherub on this end, and the other end the second, spreading their wings over the place of the ark, and shielding the cover with their wings above the ark, with their faces one to the other. That's fascinating, said Aaron. Are there any scriptures to back that up?
There are, said Natasha. Take a look at 2 Chronicles, chapter 35, verse 3.
Aaron quickly found the passage and read it aloud.
King Josiah also said to the Levites who taught all Israel and who were holy to the Lord, put the holy ark in the house which Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, built. It will be a burden on your shoulders no longer. Now serve the Lord your God and his people Israel. Now, what does that tell us? Asked Natasha. It tells us that when men did evil in the sight of the Lord, like erecting an idol in the Holy of Holies, which King Manasseh did in 2 Chronicles chapter 33, the priests who were still faithful to God actually removed the ark from the temple to keep it from being desecrated. They kept it hidden, possibly on the move, for years, until it was safe to bring it back. And then, when Josiah cleaned up the corruption of the temple and turned the people's hearts back to God, he ordered the ark brought back to the temple, and the priests readily complied. Many Jewish scholars, and not a few Christian ones, see this passage as a precedent, proof that if God once protected the ark and then made way for it to be rediscovered, as it were, then he will do it again when the time for the third temple has come. But the passage that really got Uncle Eli excited a few weeks ago was Haggai, chapter 2, verses 6 through 9.
Bennett looked over Aaron's shoulder as she found the right page.
You probably haven't spent much time studying the book of Haggai, Natasha whispered. Join the crowd. I haven't either. But about a month ago, Uncle Eli called us around 1 in the morning. He said he couldn't sleep. He was reading the ancient prophets and suddenly became convinced that he'd hit the jackpot.
Aaron read the passage aloud.
For thus says the Lord of hosts, once more in a little while I am going to shake the heavens and the earth, the sea also and the dry land. I will shake all the nations, and they will come with the wealth of all nations, and I will fill this house with glory, says the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, declares the Lord of hosts. The latter glory of this house will be greater than the former, says the Lord of hosts, and in this place I will give peace, declares the Lord of Hosts. I have to admit, said Natasha, I didn't see it at first, but as Uncle Eli explained it, it began to make too much sense. Look closely.
The Bennets reread the verses.
You see, asked Natasha, the Lord says he's going to shake the heavens and the earth. In fact, he says he's going to shake all the nations. As Uncle Eli pointed out, that's exactly what he did last October, in fulfilling Ezekiel 38 and 39. Then, look what happens next. The Lord says he will bring the wealth of the nations to Israel. That's happening too. Oil is over $200 a barrel. We've never had more money pouring in here. But, of course, that's not all. According to Haggai, the Lord will then fill this house with glory.
A rebuilt temple, said Bennett.
Exactly, said Natasha. The third temple, to be precise. Now, look a bit farther. The Lord says he's going to fill the temple with gold and silver, which he says are his. The temple treasures, said Aaron, amazed.
Natasha nodded and said, Now look at verse 9.
The latter glory of this house will be greater than the former, she noted. I asked Uncle Eli what that meant, and I have to admit, skeptic though I am, his answer intrigued me. He reminded me that the second temple, which King Herod helped construct, was an incredible physical structure, far grander and more impressive than the temple Solomon had built. But it certainly didn't have more glory than the first. Why? Because the first temple had the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark was the resting place of God's glory. The temple was originally built to be a home for the Ark, a home for God's glory. So while the second temple was remarkable in every way, it couldn't have more glory than the first temple, since it didn't have the Ark.
Okay, keep going, said Bennett, beginning to see where she was headed.
Well, just think about it, John, said Natasha. Haggai was prophesying about a future temple, a latter temple that would have more glory than the second temple. There's only one way the third temple could have more glory than the second.
She paused to let Bennett finish her thought, and he did. If it actually housed the original Ark of the Covenant. Chapter 41. Thursday, January 15th, 3:56 p.m., Tiberias, Israel. Later that afternoon, Bennett turned to Natasha. Your cousin wouldn't by any chance have a satellite phone, would she?
Actually, she does, but it's probably with her, said Natasha. But I've got one. I keep it with all my gear.
Gear?
I do a lot of digs in this area, said Natasha. Miriam used to join me when she could, before she got the new Medexco gig. Anyway, she lets me keep a lot of my junk stored here, so I don't always have to schlep it up here from Jerusalem.
You guys are close? Asked Aaron.
We used to be closer, said Natasha. After my parents died, I spent a lot of time with her, and we both worshipped my grandfather. But I guess we ended up developing two very different concepts of buried treasure. She wanted to find oil in Israel and make a fortune. That's how she got hooked up with Dmitry Galishnikov and the whole Medexco crowd. We drifted apart for a while in college, but once she started making serious money, she was certainly very generous. She started buying me all kinds of gear, for me and my best students, actually. She let me use her place as a base camp. She usually joins me on a dig for a week or two each summer, and I never know what high-tech gizmo she'll order next.
She got up and led them to a storage area off the master bedroom. In addition to shovels, trowels, brushes of all shapes and sizes, and a half-dozen metal detectors, it was a spelunker's treasure trove. Helmets, gloves, knee pads, ropes, harnesses, lights, a rack of night vision goggles, and even an array of pistols and submachine guns. It was still Israel, after all. One never knew when the next attack might come.
Ah, here it is, said Natasha, and she handed Bennett the phone.
American Consulate, may I help you?
John Bennett for Ken Costello.
Yes, sir, Mr. Bennett. One moment, I'll put you right through.
Thanks. As he sat at the kitchen table, Natasha set up Miriam Gozal's laptop computer in front of him and helped him log on to the internet to download his latest emails. There were 5 from his mother. She was worried sick about them and begged them to get back to her as soon as possible. He dashed off a quick note, saying he would call as soon as he could, but things were not going well. "Keep praying, Mom," he concluded, "and get some of your friends at that new church praying, too. We could use all the air cover we can get. Thanks. I love you. John." Costello came on the line.
"John, thank God. Are you and Aaron okay?"
"We're fine, thanks."
"You know there's an APB out for your arrest, for both of you."
"What? What are you talking about?"
"I just heard it from Rajiv,"
Costello explained.
"The Israeli police say three bodies were found murdered in Dr. Mordecai's house. Ballistics says the slugs they pulled out of them came from Aaron's Beretta."
"That was self-defense," said Bennett.
"You might have mentioned that to somebody before fleeing the scene."
"They're not the only ones after us."
"You're telling me,"
Costello said.
"You've got the whole country after you."
Aaron and Natasha now turned to listen. They were only getting one side of the conversation, of course, but it was enough to make them realize they were in serious trouble.
"Look, I'll call Aviza Doc,"
Costello offered.
"We'll bring you into the consulate and arrange a deal for you guys to turn yourselves in. Where are you right now?"
"Ken, I can't," said Bennett.
"John, you have to."
"I can't."
"Why not?"
"How do we know Avi isn't part of this thing?"
"Avi's a doc? Are you crazy? He's the head of the Mossad, for crying out loud. You think he's a terrorist?"
"I don't know what's going on right now, but the bottom line is that someone out there is trying to kill us, and Avi can't guarantee our safety, and frankly, Ken, neither can you."
"What, you think I'm in on this too?"
Costello asked. "No, of course not. I'm just saying..."
"I'm not sure you understand the gravity of the situation, John,"
Costello insisted.
"At least let me call the Prime Minister. I'm sure I can work something out with him."
"No, Ken, you're not hearing me. I'm not coming in, not yet."
"John, what are you saying? You can't run. How do you think that looks? Israel's a pretty small country. You know they're going to catch you, and then what? You're on your own. At least if you guys turn yourselves in now, the embassy will come to your defense. I'll talk to the president. He'll make sure you're okay. He owes you one, remember?"
"I'm not looking for a deal," said Bennett. "I'm looking for the people who killed my friend. That's what Mordecai asked me to do, and I gave him my word. Now you can hunt me down, or you can help me. Besides Aaron, you're about the only friend I've got right now, Ken. I could really use your help." There was a pause on the other end of the line.
"What do you need?"
asked Costello. "Two things," said Bennett. "First, there's an envelope on my dresser back at the King David. It's a private letter from Salvador Lucente to the president. Can you get it and make sure the president sees it?"
"Sure. What's it about?"
"Lucente thinks he's about to get a promotion."
"To what?"
"Secretary General."
"Of the UN? Are you kidding?"
"No, but as you can imagine, there are a boatload of implications to that," Bennett continued. "The president and NSC need to know ASAP so they can start wargaming their response."
"Okay, I'll get the letter to him. What's the second thing?"
"Aaron asked Rajiv for intel on Abdullah Farouk," said Bennett. "Do you happen to know if she found anything?" Costello hesitated for a moment, then said,
"Yeah, I do, John. She told me about the request, and I helped her look. It's not good."
Chapter 42. Thursday, January 15th, 4:21 p.m. Tel Aviv, Israel. Vigo Mariano had just landed in Tel Aviv. "Dr. Guillaume, welcome to Israel," said a voice behind him. For a moment, Mariano didn't react to the unfamiliar alias, but then he turned and smiled at the young Israeli woman from the airport's VIP office, who had been assigned to greet Mariano upon his arrival from Paris.
"Forgive me," she said, "but I just learned you were coming less than an hour ago. I understand you and your team are here for the World Health Organization?"
"Oui, oui, but we want no special attention, s'il vous plaît," Mariano said, sporting a light French accent with ease. "We just want to do our work as unobtrusively as possible, and then we will be on our way."
"We are delighted to have you here," said the young woman. "In fact, I just called our health minister. I'm afraid he was not aware of your coming, but he asked me to make sure you were taken care of and asked if you could join him for dinner in Jerusalem tonight."
For a moment, Mariano felt a flash of panic. That was the last thing he wanted.
"You are most kind, but I am afraid my colleagues and I have a very tight schedule. We must conduct our tests and get back to Paris immediately.
I am afraid, under the circumstances, we must respectfully request a rain check with the minister.
With a polite smile and a quick handshake, Mariano and his four colleagues walked briskly to the doors, jumped into a waiting World Health Organization van, and sped off.
Bennett hung up quickly and turned to Aaron and Natasha.
We have to leave, now.
Why, what is it? Asked Aaron.
I'll explain on the way. Natasha, does your cousin have a car we could borrow?
Why can't we use the Mercedes?
Every cop in Israel is looking for it.
She's got an SUV, said Natasha. A Navigator. It's in the garage.
Where does she keep the keys?
In a dish by the back door.
See if they're still there, said Bennett. Aaron and I will get the gear.
10 minutes later, they were on the road, headed north around the lake, through Capernaum, and around to the eastern shores.
So why the rush? Asked Natasha. I thought we were going to wait until dark.
Costello said Abdullah Farouk is on the move. He may be coming here.
To Israel?
To the Golan Heights, at least, through Jordan.
What? Wait a minute, said Aaron. Go back. What exactly did Ken say?
He and Rajiv did some checking on Prince Farouk, like you asked. Rajiv said he's someone the intelligence world is beginning to get very worried about. 2 weeks ago, Lee James added Farouk to Homeland Security's watch list of suspected terrorists.
Why?
Apparently, Farouk recently moved his money and his men from Saudi Arabia to somewhere in southern Europe. They're not sure where, but they believe he is actively recruiting terrorists for the Legion, the same group behind the bombing in Washington that killed George Murray, the same group the guys who attacked us at Eli's house belong to. Then, Ken called your old buddy, Danny Tracker.
What did Danny say? Asked Aaron. Who's Danny Tracker?
Natasha interjected, trying to keep up.
Sorry, said Aaron. He's the deputy director of operations at CIA. Got it. Sorry, go on.
Anyway, Bennett continued, Danny had some good news and bad news. The good news was that an agency operative spotted Farouk 3 weeks ago, arriving at the Kuwait City airport on a flight from Rome. 2 days later, Danny's financial unit spotted $25 million being routed into a Cayman Islands bank account, believed to be controlled by one of Farouk's sons. The money changed hands at least half a dozen times before arriving in the Caymans, but Danny said, as best they could tell, its origin was an Iraqi-owned shipping company. What's more, a friend of Danny's at NSA said a few days ago, they intercepted a cell phone call between a senior aide to President al-Hassani and the CEO of that Iraqi shipping company. On the call, the CEO mentioned something called Operation Black Box. Then the call was cut off.
Operation Black Box? What's that? Asked Aaron.
Actually, Danny was hoping you'd know.
I've never heard of it. Have you, Natasha?
No.
Your grandfather never mentioned it, or maybe Mordecai?
No. Not with me around, at least.
Could it be a plan to find the Ark? Said Bennett.
Maybe, said Natasha. Or a plan to kill everyone looking for the Ark.
Either way, Danny says Farouk's private jet landed in Amman this morning, Bennett continued. A CIA operative assigned to our embassy there says 12 men got off the plane, including a man matching the prince's description. They got into two vans with UN markings and went to the Jordan Archaeological Museum.
Aaron gasped.
The same place we were yesterday.
Right. An hour later, they were headed north, to the border of Syria.
So what's the problem? Asked Natasha. Can't they just move in and get them?
Bennett shook his head. That's the bad news. You know how many UN relief trucks are in Jordan right now? Our guy lost them in the crowd.
Which means he's on the loose, just across the border, said Aaron. And he may be heading straight for us.
The phone rang, and he answered it immediately. Ken Costello.
Mr. Costello, this is the White House operator. Please hold for the National Security Advisor.
A moment later, Marcia Kirkpatrick was on the line.
Any luck finding John and Aaron?
Costello explained the situation.
They're making a terrible mistake,
said Kirkpatrick.
But it sounds like there's nothing more you can do. The president wants you back in Washington right away. He wants a briefing on your meetings with Derone and Lucente, and he wants to see that letter Lucente gave John.
The sun had not yet set, but they couldn't wait. Bennett knew they had to get into those tunnels before Farouk and his team did. He just prayed they weren't already too late.
There, take a left, Aaron said suddenly.
Bennett pulled off onto a dirt road. He came to a stop and cut the lights. Just over the ridge, Israeli and UN peacekeeping forces were busy burying the dead and trying to keep deadly diseases from triggering a global pandemic. Here, for now at least, all was quiet, but they dared not attract attention. Natasha's night vision equipment was designed to be used inside caves, not off-roading through old minefields, but it would do. They proceeded up the side of the mountain for another 20 minutes. It was agreed that Bennett and Aaron would be the scroll hunters. Natasha would take the truck back down the mountain to avoid suspicion, monitor police and military frequencies, stay in constant communication with the Bennetts via encrypted wireless radios, and come back for them when the time was right. "How much farther?" Bennett asked. Aaron used a penlight to double-check the coordinates from Ray Donovan's message, then took another GPS reading. "Another half mile on the left," she said. A few moments later, she tapped John on the shoulder. "Pull over," she said. "We'll have to walk from here." Chapter 43. Thursday, January 15th, 5:47 p.m., the Golan Heights. The sun was gone, and the moon had not taken its place. Thick clouds covered the night sky, and a strong breeze swept through the mountains. Bennett and Aaron hiked for another 15 minutes and then began hunting through the thick brush for the cave opening Donovan had described in such detail in his notes. They never would have found it without the GPS coordinates, Bennett realized. The small opening was completely concealed. When they finally found it, the opening was just large enough to squeeze through. Bennett lowered his equipment first, then strapped on the MP5 machine gun Natasha had given him and lowered himself into the cave. There was no telling who or what was already in there, but he was not about to let Aaron go first into the unknown. The air inside was cold and moist, the walls were damp and mossy, the granite floor was thick with mud. "You okay?" he asked when Aaron joined him, also outfitted with an MP5. "Yeah, I guess," she said. "How about you?" "I'd rather be back in that honeymoon suite in Rhonda, that's for sure."
"Me too," she said wistfully. "Me too."
They helped each other put on the hefty backpacks full of gadgets and supplies, then flicked on the flashlights atop their weapons and began moving forward, weaving through stalagmites and stalactites. The tunnel was narrower than Bennett had expected, without much headroom, giving him a feeling of claustrophobia he had never experienced before. The farther they walked, the colder it became. Bennett's mind began wandering as they probed deeper into the tunnel. He wondered what had happened to Donovan and Harkin. How far had they gone? How close had they come? How had they died? The cobwebs were thick in his face, suggesting that no one had been down here in quite some time. With any luck, they had beat Farouk and his minions to the punch. On the other hand, they had no guarantee they were on the right track. All they really had to go on were the scribblings of a dead Syrian rabbi and the testimony of two rogue CIA agents willing to sell out their country for buried treasure that might not even be real. Soon, the granite below his feet began sloping downward at a fairly steep angle. Bennett steadied himself against the cold, wet walls, but behind him, he heard Aaron lose her balance and slam onto her back. With nothing to grab onto, nothing to break her fall, she began sliding, picking up speed as she plunged into the icy darkness. Instinctively, he reached out to grab her, but she was moving too fast. Her screams echoed through the tunnel chambers, silenced only by an enormous splash as she hit the surface of the springs below. Aaron gasped for air, but she needed more. The bone-chilling waters seemed to suck all the energy from her body. She thrashed around, desperately trying to regain her footing, but the weight of her pack began pulling her under. She was sinking, sinking fast, and she had no idea what to do. She expected to touch bottom any moment, but there was nothing there, nothing to grab onto, nothing to push off of. Terrified, she wrestled with the backpack, trying to unhook it and get it off her back before she drowned. She managed to pry it loose and slip away, but she was still going down. She tried to kick off her boots, heavy and now waterlogged, but they were tied too tightly. She couldn't get them off. The gun was gone. The pack was gone. Tens of thousands of dollars of Natasha's gear was gone, and she was still sinking. Bennett expected Aaron to resurface any moment, but there was no sign of her, just a mass of bubbles that were fading quickly. With his adrenaline pumping, he moved with desperate caution, working his way down the sloped tunnel floor, trying to get to the water's edge without slipping in himself. When he got to the bottom, he made his way around the edge of the pool to another tunnel that shot off to one side. He tore off his backpack and gloves and tossed them into the side tunnel along with his gun. Then he quickly untied his boots, ripped them and his socks off his feet, and plunged in head first. The frigid water instantly numbed his hands and feet, and a shock of pain shot through his skull. The icy temperatures stung his eyes, and he was forced to close them. But it wouldn't have mattered anyway. The water was pitch black. He wouldn't have been able to see Erin if she had been just inches away. His lungs screamed for oxygen. His hands grasped for his wife. Though he could barely feel his legs now, he kicked as hard as he could, trying to close the gap. Suddenly, finally, Erin felt her feet hit rock. She bent her knees to cushion her landing and then sprang back up with all the force she could muster. Up, up she crawled, her legs flailing, her lungs burning, her body freezing, her heart racing. Out of nowhere, she felt John's hand and felt hope jolt through her body like a charge of electrical current. Bennett's hands clamped onto Erin's. He had her, and he would never let her go. But now he had another problem. How to stop his descent? He had to reverse course and pull her and himself back to the surface. But his weight and the added weight of their soaked clothing was making it almost impossible to gain upward momentum. Suddenly, as they thrashed about in the murky darkness, they slammed against something cold and hard. He felt a jagged shard of rock slice deep into his knee. He had almost no air left in his lungs. It was everything he could do not to scream out in pain. But instead, he wedged his foot into the side of the razor-sharp crag and used it as leverage to push his way up. The pain in his foot shot through him like a knife. It was unlike anything he had ever felt before, worse even than when he had been shot a few years before. But it worked. A moment later, he felt Erin pushing off the edge as well, and soon they both burst to the surface, gasping for air. But there was no time for rejoicing. Erin suddenly went limp. He dragged her to the side and scrambled up to the rocky edge while still holding fast to her shirt and arms. Then, using every last ounce of energy he had, he pulled her out of the water and into the side tunnel and rolled her onto her back. To his horror, he realized she wasn't breathing. Chapter 44. Thursday, January 15th, 7:01 p.m., the Golan Heights. An Israeli Apache gunship rose over the ridge. It made a low sweep over the western slopes, its spotlight on and directed toward the ground. Was this a normal patrol, Natasha wondered, or were they hunting for someone? Were they hunting for them? Were the authorities on to them already? Natasha was almost a mile from the tunnel opening. She was parked in a roadside rest area near Kibbutz Ein Gev on the eastern shores of the Sea of Galilee. But she had a clear view of the Golan Heights, and she watched as the chopper made one pass and then another. Forgetting the code words they had agreed upon, she grabbed the radio and whispered, "Guys, are you there? We have a little situation up here. Come in, over." She waited a moment, but there was no response. "Guys, seriously, we've got a problem. There's an Apache sweeping back and forth over your location. I repeat, an Israeli gunship over your location. How much longer are you guys going to be?" Bennett was now giving his wife mouth-to-mouth, but nothing was working. A minute went by, then another, but it felt like an hour. Bennett was begging God to let Erin live. She couldn't die. She couldn't leave him. Not here, not like this. They'd only been married a few days. It wasn't fair, he argued. Why would God do this to them? Why would he give them a taste of the happiness of being together and then rip them apart forever? "Hey, guys, are you there?" Natasha checked the frequency and the batteries and tried again. "Base camp to Angel 1, Angel 2, are you okay? Come in, over." But there was still no response, and now she began to fear the worst. Suddenly, Erin gagged. Bennett turned her head, and she began vomiting uncontrollably. But she was back. She was breathing. And he began to sob. He held her in his arms for what seemed like an eternity, rubbing her face and hands, trying to keep her warm. His mind reeled. What was he supposed to do now? She obviously couldn't keep going forward, but how in the world was he going to get her back to the surface? He grabbed the radio. "Base camp, this is Angel One. Do you read me? Over."
"John, it's me,"
replied a startled Natasha.
"Are you okay?"
Hey, no names," he insisted.
"Right, I'm sorry, I forgot. But where are you guys? I've been calling you forever."
Bennett explained what happened. "I'm afraid she's slipping into hypothermia," he said. "I need to get her out."
"John, listen to me. If she's hypothermic, you have to stabilize her. You can't move her yet."
There was silence for a moment. Then Bennett said, "Did you hear what I just said? She's unconscious. We need to get her out of here and fast."
"If you move her in this condition, she could get worse or die,"
said Natasha urgently.
"You need to raise her core temperature right away."
"What do I do?" Bennett asked.
"Do you still have your backpacks?"
asked Natasha. "Aaron's is gone, but I've still got mine."
"Open it. Tell me what's in there."
"Why? What are you talking about?"
"It's either archaeological gear or medical supplies,"
Natasha said.
"I don't remember which of you had which."
Bennett set down the radio and scrambled to find the pack. He dragged it over to Aaron's side and quickly rifled through its contents. "Okay, got it," he told Natasha. "I see several blankets and a large first aid kit."
"Okay, good. Put the blankets over her,"
Natasha instructed.
"Then dig to the bottom of the pack."
"What am I looking for?"
"A tan pouch about the size of a small transistor radio."
"Yeah, I see it."
"Unzip it. It's an IV warmer. Put a bag of fluid in there and turn it on."
Natasha waited until Bennett's voice came back over the radio. "Okay, done. Now what?"
"There's an LED reading on the top. Do you see it?"
"Yes."
"What's it say?"
101.
"Good,"
said Natasha.
"When it hits 104, give her the IV. It'll bring up her core temperature. Do you see a long, narrow, black canvas bag right there?"
"Yes."
"Open it. There's a special thermometer for taking core temperature readings."
"I see it. Now what?" Natasha quickly explained how to use it.
"What kind of reading are you getting?"
"She's at 92.1, Bennett said.
"Do you have a flashlight handy?"
"Yes."
"Check her pupils."
"They're constricted."
"But are they reacting to the light?"
"A little, yes."
"How's her pulse?"
"Weak, but she's hanging in there."
"Okay, check the IV warmer."
105.
"Perfect. Give it to her now."
With Aaron's blood vessels so constricted, Bennett had trouble finding a good vein. When he finally did and breathed a sigh of relief, Aaron suddenly went into convulsions. "Oh no, Aaron!" Bennett shouted.
"What's happening?"
came Natasha's voice over the radio. Bennett couldn't answer. He was terrified. Aaron's back arched. She shook violently. Then, as quickly as she began, she stopped. "She was convulsing," Bennett reported. "But now she's stopped." Immediately, Aaron's body started shaking again. "Now she's convulsing again. What do I do?"
"Don't worry,"
Natasha said.
"Her body is just reacting to the temperature change. Just keep her stable and make sure the IV doesn't come loose."
Bennett did as Natasha instructed, praying aloud the whole time, asking Jesus to heal and comfort the woman he loved so much. He didn't care what Natasha thought. He didn't even realize the radio was still on. He just couldn't bear the thought of living without Aaron, the woman who had saved his life again and again.
"John, do you see another canvas case in there?"
"I do."
"That's a special ventilator,"
said Natasha.
"It pumps heated air. There should be a 12-volt battery pack in there."
"Yeah, it's right here."
"Good. Hook it up, turn it on, and get it on her right away."
It seemed to work. After 8 or 10 minutes, the convulsions subsided, and Bennett began to relax. Aaron's temperature was up to 96.4. Her pulse was stronger. And after a few minutes, her eyes began to flutter open.
"John,"
she asked, her voice weak and groggy. "I'm right here, sweetheart," he replied, putting his hand on her forehead. She mumbled something else, but it was barely a whisper. "Just rest, Aaron," he told her. "It's okay. Everything's going to be all right." But she tried to speak again. "What's that?" he asked. "What did you say?"
"Did we get it?"
she asked, barely audible. Bennett was stunned at the question. "What, the scroll?" Aaron couldn't seem to nod. She barely had enough energy to speak, but she blinked hard as if she was trying to say yes. Bennett shook his head, amazed at her focus, even now, with all that she had just been through. I'm afraid that's going to have to wait, Aaron. We need to get you out of here and find a hospital.
No, she whispered back emphatically. You go.
A moment later, however, she had slipped back into unconsciousness. Bennett radioed Natasha, his voice thick with emotion.
She just blacked out.
That's after drop,
Natasha explained.
It's normal. It's part of the process. She's going to be out for a while, but she'll be fine, I promise.
Bennett took a deep breath and tried to believe that. He rechecked Erin's temperature every 5 minutes, and sure enough, it slowly began to rise, as did her pulse. He thought about what Aaron had just said. It was a crazy thought. He couldn't bear the idea of leaving her here all by herself, even for a little while. Who knew what lay ahead? But then again, given all that they had been through already, how could they give up now? Chapter 45. Thursday, January 15th, 8:16 p.m. The Road to Tiberias. Viggo Mariano and his men sped up Highway 90. Unless they hit traffic or police roadblocks, neither of which he expected, they would be in Tiberias in the next 10 to 15 minutes. Mariano pulled out a satellite phone and hit speed dial. Abdullah Farouk's voice came on the line.
Where are you?
He demanded. We're almost there, Mariano assured him. How about you?
I'm safe in Amman. The rest of the team is in position in the north. They just called. You were right, the UN vans worked like a charm. The hills are swarming with blue helmets. They blend right in. No one has even asked for ID. Perhaps I should have gone with them.
No, said Mariano. You need to stick with the plan and keep out of sight. What about the communications equipment I sent?
They've got it, and they're sweeping every frequency as you requested,
said Farouk.
They've found nothing yet, but they've promised to call the moment they do.
Don't worry, Mr. Farouk, Mariano said. These guys are very good. If Bennett and his wife and the Barak girl are up there, they'll find them and neutralize them. On that, you have my word. Aaron wasn't the only one battling hypothermia. It was pure adrenaline and the grace of God that had kept Bennett from slipping into shock as well. But he couldn't just sit there. Shivering and soaked to the bone, he checked on Aaron again. She was out, cold, as it were. He picked up the radio and pressed send. Angel 1 to base camp, do you copy? Over. An instant later, Natasha came on the line.
Base camp to Angel 1, how's she doing?
She seems to have stabilized.
Should I come back up there to get you guys?
Bennett hesitated, but only for a moment. He knew the stakes, and he knew time was running out. But he also knew that if the scroll was still here, it wouldn't be for long. No, not yet, he replied.
Why?
Asked Natasha, worry rising in her voice.
What's the matter?
Bennett paused to catch his breath, then said, I'm going for it.
You're gonna do what?
But Bennett didn't respond. He stuffed the radio back into his coat and checked Erin's temperature again. It was 97.1. Her pulse was improving. Her head was resting on his backpack, and she was wrapped in two thick wool blankets. He gave her a kiss on the forehead and said a brief prayer. Then he scooped up his MP5, double-checked Donovan's map, and proceeded as rapidly as he could down the tunnel. 10 minutes later, as he raced through an ever-narrowing passageway, a cruel thought crossed his mind. Aaron's backpack had had the shovels and the metal detector. So even if he found his way to the right place, even if he found the scroll, which still seemed highly unlikely, what was he supposed to do then? How was he supposed to dig it up? It had been buried for more than 2,000 years. He shook off the thought and kept moving. He would simply have to blow up that bridge when he came to it. The good news, the farther he went, the drier the tunnel got. The bad news, it was getting colder, much colder, and his hands and feet were already numb. His gloves were soaked, so he'd left them behind. At least his socks and boots were dry, but he was shivering uncontrollably. He could feel his reflexes growing sluggish, and his head was throbbing. And then more bad news. The tunnel abruptly branched off in four directions. Which route did he want? Which route had Donovan and Harkin taken, if they had even made it this far? He pulled the map from his pocket and studied it carefully, but there was no indication of a fork. He had hit another wall. Aaron was waiting for him. He didn't have time to check all these tunnels. He barely had time to check one. "Call to me, and I will answer you, and I will tell you great and mighty things which you do not know." Mordecai's verse came back to mind. It had worked before. Maybe the Lord would bless him again. God certainly knew where the scroll was. And didn't Jesus say, "Seek and you will find"? There was no time like the present. He set the gun down and got on his knees to pray. When he opened his eyes again, he noticed, dead ahead of him, small bits of dried mud in almost a zigzag pattern. Curious, he picked up several pieces and examined them more closely. They were from the tread of a boot. Someone had been here before. Not in the last few minutes, but a whole lot more recently than 2,000 years ago. Could Donovan and Harkin have made it this far? Could these be their boot prints? Who else could possibly have been down here? A smile crossed his face for the first time in days. "Thank you, Father," he whispered. Then he grabbed the MP5 again and followed the prints. He heard the noise of a helicopter overhead. It sounded military and Apache. Were the Israelis onto them? It didn't really matter, he realized. There was nothing he could do about it now. He had to keep moving. Bennett pressed ahead another 200 yards before coming to another fork. He stopped again, caught his breath, and double-checked the map and his watch. None of these forks were marked, but the map did indicate that the spring waters of the Yarmouk River were nearby, and the markings on the map seemed to indicate that the ancient smuggler tunnels followed the path of the underground springs to the river itself. He closed his eyes and strained to listen to every sound. The helicopter had briefly passed out of range, and now he noticed that, through the smaller of the two tunnel branches, he could hear the ever-so-faint sound of water trickling in the distance. That had to be it. He crawled into the small tunnel, and before long was scrambling down a muddy embankment. The only way forward was through more icy waters, but at least he'd found the river, and his heart was racing. He had to be incredibly close now.
Angel 1 to base camp, over.
Base camp, over, said Natasha. He heard the strain in her voice. She was increasingly fearful of getting caught.
You still with me?
Asked Bennett. Absolutely. What do you need?
What's it looking like up there?
Not good, she admitted. There are now 3 choppers in the air. No, wait, there's a 4th. They're passing by every few minutes. I think they're onto us. You need to get Angel 2 out of there now.
Any boots on the ground?
Natasha picked up her pair of night vision binoculars and scanned the horizon. There was a patrol that went by about 45 minutes ago. I don't see anything else at the moment.
What about the radios?
They're using encrypted channels. The police bands have been pretty quiet. How much longer?
I don't know,
said Bennett.
Just start thinking about how we get Angel 2 out of here.
Will do, she said, but the truth was, she had no idea. It suddenly dawned on Bennett how much danger he was in. His wife was battling hypothermia, as was he, but rather than getting either of them back to safety, he was advancing deep into the demilitarized zone between Israel and Syria, moving under an active minefield almost to a waterfall on the border with Syria, with Israeli gunships buzzing overhead, hunting a treasure that almost no one on the planet believed actually existed. Some honeymoon. The tunnel now narrowed sharply to a small hole in the granite floor. Bennett tossed a rock into the hole to gauge its depth, then pointed the flashlight of the MP5 to see what was down there. No rodents, no vipers, just a claustrophobic's nightmare. He lowered himself into the hole, then dropped to his belly and crawled forward about 20 or 30 yards. He soon found himself crawling through a partially collapsed tunnel, and when he came around the next corner, he thought his heart would stop. He was staring into a man's eyes. Chapter 46. Thursday, January 15th, 9:07 p.m., the Golan Heights. Eye sockets, to be more precise. Bennett shuddered. Not 6 inches from his face, a skull stared back at him, and scattered behind it were shattered pieces of bone and electronics and small shreds of clothing. He pushed the skull aside and pulled himself into the slightly larger tunnel. To one side, he found a CIA-issued firearm. A few feet away, he found the dead man's wallet. He took a deep breath and opened it. The credit cards and the Continental Airlines ID gave the name Marcus T. Morelli, as did the Virginia driver's license, but the face was Ray Donovan's. He recognized Donovan immediately from the photo his brother had included in the materials he'd sent to Mordecai, and shuddered. No wonder the agency had never found him. He'd been blown up by an underground landmine. Bennett picked through the mangled metal device and scorched pieces of wiring scattered about. Might there be more mines down here? He stuffed the wallet into his pocket and kept moving, crawling into an antechamber another dozen yards ahead. This room seemed much bigger than the last one, and the sound of the distant helicopter was much louder here. Looking around, Bennett realized that this once hidden antechamber was now partially exposed to the northeast. The far side of the room had collapsed at some point, leaving a small mountain of rock and dirt in the center of the room. He would have to move fast. He couldn't stay exposed here for long. He looked at the floor again and found more bones. Unlike the first pile, though, these formed an intact skeleton. The man's clothes had largely been eaten away by rats and other rodents, as had presumably his flesh, but Bennett had no doubt who it was. Sure enough, he quickly found a moldy leather wallet. Again, the credit cards and various IDs were all in the names of an alias, but it was Harkin all right. How had he died? Bennett wondered. He knelt down to examine the remains and found two bullet holes in the skull, one in the back down by the base of the neck and the other dead center in the deceased's forehead. Harkin had been murdered, senselessly killed at the age of 25, but by whom? Had somebody known they were coming? Or had Harkin been cut down by a Syrian sniper? Bennett wondered whether the tunnel had been partially collapsed when Donovan and Harkin had come here. Maybe a sniper had seen Harkin, his attention drawn by the sound of the landmine exploding. Thunder rumbled through the night sky, and again, Bennett realized he would have to hurry if he wanted to avoid Harkin's fate. There were two shovels near the mound of dirt and rock in the center of the room, undisturbed by time. That must be where they had been digging. His heart accelerated. As terrible as he felt for what had happened to these two men, he was suddenly oddly grateful for their sacrifice and for the clues they had left behind for Mordecai and thus for him. They had come so far and gotten so close, and now he was about to discover what they had not, whether this really was the final resting place of the key scroll. He peeked out the gaping hole to the northeast and scanned for signs of life, but saw nothing. He could hear the choppers not far away, and he knew that UN relief forces were operating nearby. But the chances that they would hear him had to be minimal, he figured, so he grabbed a shovel and began to dig.
Jackknife to black box.
Black box, go.
I've got something.
Excitement spread through Mariano's team. What is it?
Movement to the southwest, half a click from the old Syrian bunker.
How many?
Looks like just one, sir. He's inside the collapsed tunnel. Hold on. Let me see if I can get a better angle.
No, don't move, Mariano ordered. Nothing that could attract attention. Nomad, can you see anything from your position?
No, sir.
What about... But before Mariano could finish the thought, his lead sniper broke back in.
Jackknife to black box. He just moved into plain view.
Who is it? Can you see?
Negative. It's too dark.
Is it Bennett? Mariano pressed.
I can't tell, but he's definitely alone, and he's digging.
Mariano couldn't believe it. Their inside source had come through for them again, giving the exact coordinates of where the Bennetts were headed, and just in time. Then Jackknife radioed again.
I've got a clear shot,
he told Mariano.
Should I take it?
What's he doing now? Mariano asked.
Digging furiously,
came the reply.
But I've still got a shot. Should I take it?
Bennett struck metal. Exhausted, he nevertheless dug faster. The exercise was, after all, helping to warm his frozen body a little, and he was thrilled beyond belief at the possibility of what he was about to find. Soon he had uncovered a small trunk, which he promptly yanked from the ground. The lid was stuck. Bennett pulled a knife from his pocket. Again, Mariano's radio crackled to life.
I have the shot,
said Jackknife.
I repeat, I have the shot. Can I take it?
Hold one, Jackknife, hold one, Mariano barked into the radio. He pulled out his sat phone and speed-dialed Farouk. We've got him, he said the moment Farouk answered.
Who?
Bennett. One of my men has him in his sights. What do you want to do?
Are you with him?
No. No, he's on the Syrian side, I'm on the Israeli side, but I've got him on the other line, and he needs authorization, fast. Mariano's radio came to life. It was Jackknife again.
He's got something.
Hold on, Mr. Farouk, said Mariano, grabbing the radio. What have you got, Jackknife?
He's got something. It's in his hands.
What? What is it?
It's a box of some kind.
What's he doing?
He's trying to pry it open.
Farouk was screaming on the other end of the line, demanding to know what was happening. Mariano explained while Jackknife fed him second-by-second updates.
He's got it open, said the sniper.
He's got it open, Mariano repeated into the phone. What do you want me to do, Mr. Farouk? Do we take him out? I need to know now. Bennett had no idea that his head was centered in a sniper's scope. All he could think of was the scroll in his hands. It was small and metal, probably copper like the other, oxidized and encrusted with 20 centuries of dirt and filth. He had no idea how they were going to get it open. It felt as though it could disintegrate into a fine powder at any moment. Something to worry about later, for now he had to get back to Aaron and get both of them out of there alive.
Where are you?
Asked Farouk. Tiberias.
How long will it take you and your team to get into the Golan?
Another 20 or 30 minutes, why?
Get moving now, said Farouk. I'll explain while you're en route.
Mariano was beside himself. Fine, but what do I tell my man? He's got the shot. I say he should take it.
Angel 1 to base camp. The Eagle has landed.
Natasha heard the words, but couldn't believe them.
Base camp to Angel 1. Come again? Natasha asked, her voice trembling with emotion.
The Eagle has landed,
Bennett repeated.
I'm coming home.
Jackknife steadied his rifle and adjusted his scope. He had to account for the strong breeze now picking up through the valley. He would likely have only one shot, and he had to get it right. Farouk finally made the call.
Tell your man to hold his fire, he ordered.
What? Said Mariano, apoplectic.
Tell your man not to shoot.
Why not? We may not get another chance like this.
It's the scroll I want, not the Bennett's,
Farouk growled. We cannot do both, Mariano insisted. Let me take this guy out, and I'll go into the tunnel and recover the scroll myself.
No,
said Farouk.
It's too risky. You start shooting, and that whole mountain is going to be teeming with special forces. You'll never get another chance to get in there.
Mariano couldn't believe what he was hearing. But if they get it, Farouk cut him off.
Then we'll follow them.
What if they take the scroll to the authorities? Asked Mariano, nearly ready to authorize Jackknife to take the shot anyway.
Haven't you been listening to the news?
Farouk demanded.
The Bennett's are wanted for murder. They're not going to the authorities.
They could cut a deal.
Then we'll cut their throats.
When? Mariano wanted to know, eager to do the job himself.
After they lead us to the treasures,
said Farouk.
Let them get the scroll out of the tunnels, then follow them. If they head to the police station, kill them. But I guarantee you that's not going to happen. They want the treasure. That's what they're going after. After all, it's the only leverage they can use to stay out of prison.
There was silence on the other end of the line.
And think about it, Vigo,
Farouk added.
Who is more likely to decode the scroll? The Barak woman and the Bennett's? Or you?
Chapter 47. Friday, January 16th, 6:46 a.m., Tiberias, Israel. Erin had no idea where she was. She stared up at a ceiling fan for almost 5 minutes before she noticed it wasn't spinning. Slowly, painfully, she turned her head to the right. All she found was wallpaper she didn't recognize. When she finally turned all the way to the left, she found a small night table, a lamp that was off, and a digital alarm clock that told her it was morning, though of what day she hadn't the foggiest idea. A few minutes later, she noticed the electric blankets wrapped around her and the needle stuck in her arm, attached by a tube to a bag of fluid hanging from the bedpost. She noticed that her feet were wrapped in thick bandages. Slowly, she began to remember flashes of the cave, the water, John's face, John and Natasha pulling her out of the tunnel and putting her in the back of the SUV. But no sooner did it all register than she once again drifted away into a long and dreamless sleep. Bennett stepped out of another long, hot shower. As he dressed, he tried to clear his head and think about the next steps, but it was still almost impossible to believe that they had all made it this far. He checked in on Erin. Her pulse and temperature were both back to normal. Breathing a sigh of relief, he kissed her on the cheek and went down to the kitchen to make some coffee. It was going to be a long day. Downstairs, Bennett found Natasha hard at work at the kitchen table, tools and brushes and bottles of solvent spread everywhere. "How's it going?" he asked.
"Slow," said Natasha. "I've been up all night with it."
"Well, not to put any pressure on you or anything, but you are aware that the